the natural right of Iran to increase the level of enrichment. So this is a detail. This impact in negotiations between Iran and the United States is indirect in negotiations. It is very important for both sides to discuss on the details, such details that you refer to. If it is going to have more sanctions, some sanctions on Iran, so this is the natural right of Iran to have more nuclear enrichment. But Iran is ready, as authorities at Iran have claimed many times, Iran is ready to return to the same nuclear deal that was signed in 2015.
Israel's direct or indirect sabotage didn't stop at that. Next, after Palestine's Hamas movement retaliated to Israeli strikes on Palestinians, significantly on Monday, May the 10th, U.S. Republicans stepped up calls on Joe Biden, 13th May, to end talks with Iran. That was in case sanctions relief untied Iran's hands to further support Hamas. Biden disagreed, but in continuing to demand Iran destroy the new generation IR 4, 6, and 9 centrifuges, among others. And that's just for now.
The JCPOA is a new means of colonization. Today, colonizing countries no longer impose their agenda with machine guns, tanks, warplanes, and missiles, but with economic, financial, and political tools. Take the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank, for example, which aims at colonizing other nations. Their tools are different. They are monetary and financial tools denominated by the dollar. I believe the JCPOA is one of such tools, but presented nicely. It's the same concept the leader of the Islamic Revolution has said before: velvet gloves that cover iron-cast hands.
The U.S. administration wants to return to the JCPOA as a first step. Next, it will be demanding a JCPOA plus or even a JCPOA 2. It's no wonder Iran passed the law earlier on to give them a deadline by threatening to cease cooperation with the IAEA or UN nuclear watchdog. The foreign ministry negotiating team, however, sees hope with the more delicate approach of talks and continued diplomacy. Iranian parliament has pretty much alerted the U.S. to a late May deadline for lifting sanctions off Iran and returning to the JCPOA. Get back in by then, or let's leave the JCPOA alone once and for all, so to speak. But might lawmakers here have softened their tone to give Iranian negotiators in Vienna a better chance at smoothing out the platform for a JCPOA revival? Well, I might have gotten a little carried away with this one, adding too much spice. But we've got a chief announcer and giver of ultimatums to moderate and give us a notion of the parliamentary mood. That would be Mr. Mojtaba Zonnur, head of the Parliamentary National Security and Foreign Policy Committee.
The Strategic Action Plan Act, passed by the parliament, is, as the leader of the Islamic Revolution said, a good law that needs to be implemented. That's why the parliament remains steadfast in its position regarding the law. If the May 24 deadline agreed with the IAEA Director General is missed and the Iranian government wants to extend the time, it will be found in breach of the law. The violator will be subject to Article 9 of the law, which has criminalized that and defined punishments to those who object to or obstruct the legislation. The parliament remains firm on its position regarding the matter.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister, Seyed Abbas Araghchi, who is leading Iran's negotiating team in Vienna, said the deal may be extended. He did express hope, however, that enough progress will be made so that there will be no need for an extension. But if needed, Iran will consider an extension at a proper time.
We enacted several clauses in the law for lifting sanctions. One clause required the government to immediately begin ramping up Iran's nuclear activities, including installing newer generation centrifuges and reviving the heavy water sectors in Arak, Fordow, and Natanz sites. We also defined a time frame for our withdrawal from implementing the additional protocol, meaning to decrease the excess and snap inspections for the IAEA. We started playing the same game that they are.
Given that extending to the deadline might give the wrong signal and lead to misconceptions and miscalculations on the other side, that Iran isn't serious in its positions, the parliament won't allow an extension. This is so the enemy respects our regulations and understands that once we made a commitment, it can't be changed. If we're not serious about this, the other side would understandably act negligently in performing its duties. That's why we need to stand firm in enforcing the law.
The United States has accepted much of what it ought to do, but there are also some sanctions the U.S. is not willing to lift, said Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh. But Iran has made it clear that these sanctions were imposed to destroy the JCPOA and prevent Iran from reaping benefits from the JCPOA, and thus must be removed.
According to the nuclear deal, sanctions on Iran are categorized by two groups. First, sanctions by the executive orders and sanctions by the Congress acts. According to this deal, the United States government is committed to remove all the sanctions by the executive deal. But for sanctions by the Congress acts, the U.S. government, the President of the United States, is committed to suspend those sanctions. So for Iran, what is important is that to remove the barriers on sanctions, on economic sanctions, which have had essential impacts on the Iranian economy.
It's no secret the U.S. wants to keep some sanctions in place to use them as leverage to expand talks beyond the JCPOA. As leverage in the follow-up talks they wish to initiate with Tehran on JCPOA timelines, as well as Iran's non-nuclear activities. The U.S. has put sanctions into three baskets, green, yellow, and red, depending on how clearly they are inconsistent with the deal. Green will be lifted, yellow is to be negotiated, and red will stay.
A two-level relationship between Iran and the United States that would enable the two sides to directly discuss the matters in person could help clear up some misunderstandings and improve the process of talks, because the negotiations are being held based on distrust, and while such views persist, we can't expect desired results, even on a tactical level.
Plenty more to be said, but let's make a break in our words to see what other media outlets have to say. Stay with me for a quick media review. And here's how it is in the words of others. How desperately does Iran really want sanctions lifted? The Middle East Monitor says why Iran can live without a nuclear deal. Most of the international community, barring Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, welcomes the recent developments regarding the revival of the JCPOA, especially after four turbulent years under the previous Donald Trump administration. But expectations of a revival of the nuclear deal do not necessarily mean that is going to happen, not in a seamless fashion anyway. After weathering the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign, Iran feels both vindicated and defiant. Combined with the country's enhanced leverage in the form of more advanced centrifuges, this state of mind indicates Iran is in no mood to compromise. From an Iranian point of view, while a lasting nuclear deal may be desirable for economic reasons, it is not necessarily indispensable. The Islamic Republic can continue to thrive in the world without the JCPOA. We've got a piece by SP Global. What would it mean to Iran's rival oil producers if sanctions were lifted? Sanctions relief for Iran would pressure rival heavy crude condensate producers. Four rounds of indirect talks between the U.S. and Iran have so far failed to achieve a breakthrough in negotiations to revive the nuclear deal. But rival producers and traders have been eyeing how the competitive landscape may shift if sanctions are lifted on Iranian oil sales. Most experts expect an agreement on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action to be reached within months, if not weeks, which would eventually bring some 2 million barrels per day of Iranian oil back to the market, 2 million barrels. Much of Iran's production is of heavier grades than condensate, and a relaxation of the sanctions will put pressure on the likes of neighboring Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Oman, and even Texas crackers. Refineries worldwide, meanwhile, will likely cheer the extra availability of Iranian crude. The refining hubs of Asia, China, India, South Korea, Japan, and Singapore, have regularly processed Iranian grades, as the high sulfur content and heavy or medium density fit the diet of these complex plants. We've got the Financial Tribune and why it matters to Iran that banking sanctions be lifted. Iranian banking industry wants definite sanctions relief. Iran is pushing for its banking industry to be given guaranteed and conclusive sanctions relief at talks to restore the country's nuclear deal with world powers. The removal of sanctions against the central bank, Iranian banks, SWIFT, and any money transfer between them and major foreign correspondent banks needs to be verified. Abdel Nasser Hemmati, the governor of the Central Bank of Iran, told Bloomberg, referring to restrictions on Iranian access to the Belgium-based global payment system. Hemmati said that officials from the central bank are directly involved in the talks to ensure U.S. sanctions removal is tangible. Due to the sanctions imposed by Trump, deals with U.S. companies after the 2015 JCPOA signing that were technically permitted, such as plans to purchase dozens of airliners from Boeing Company, either crept forward or were impossible to complete. Donald Trump, the controversial former U.S. president, piled hundreds more penalties on Iranian lenders, including the central bank, as it ramped up pressure on Tehran. That would be it for this segment, but do stay tuned. Iran rejects any categorization of sanctions to partially lift them. Be they Obama-era sanctions or Trump-fancy sanctions, be they recognized as JCPOA-related or unrelated. Although Iran maintains they are all JCPOA-related and the U.S. seems to agree deep down.
Iran is insistent on some of its internal policies. They are also insisting that Iran abandons and readjusts those policies. It doesn't appear that the two would mix well or the JCPOA would be able to work to Iran's benefits, albeit in a minimal way. Iran wants all sanctions removed, but many sanctions aren't JCPOA related. Even if 50% of JCPOA related sanctions are suspended and not lifted, it would be a positive development for Iran.
Anyhow, it was the U.S. that pulled out of the deal, disregarding UNSC Resolution 2231, which the JCPOA rests on. In other words, it was the U.S. that caused the standoff with a mess of sanctions imposed later to sabotage the JCPOA. That was in the Trump era, but even Joe Biden for months refused to lift any sanctions before Iran takes the first step to recommitting. U.S. pressures have only been backfiring. Here's a point. Practice of the law can only be so different from what the law says. And the way the U.S. and allies have boldly gone about the deal as those who were never meant to lift sanctions to begin with makes you wonder just that. Was the JCPOA never meant to lift sanctions off this country, only to temporarily suspend them?
First, it's not the removal of all sanctions. We had this ambiguity with our colleagues in the foreign ministry. They said according to the JCPOA, all sanctions would be lifted without any preconditions on the date the deal was signed. But we said it won't happen for two reasons. One is the nature of the imperialist system that won't allow it, and the second is the text that was being signed. The JCPOA text has tied the lifting of sanctions to tens of preconditions. If you consider how the sanctions are planned to be removed in the JCPOA, which doesn't include all anti-Iran sanctions, you'll notice that practically nothing will happen.
Earlier on in the talks, Abbas Araghchi said Iran requires no roadmap to restore the deal. In our view, there is no step-by-step plan. We only have a final step that the U.S. needs to take to lift the sanctions it has imposed, reimposed, or relabeled during the past 4 years. We will verify, and then Iran will return to its commitments. That's not all. Iran wants guarantees from the U.S. and its Western European partners that sanctions won't be reimposed on this country as soon as the deal gets going. because then the U.S. as a member will have the power to trigger the snapback mechanism. That way, all sanctions can come flooding Iran all in one go. However, Joe Biden seems too level-headed to act outside strategy to unnecessarily cause a breach of trust. Now, are all sanctions really vital to lift? So what if high-up individuals remain on the U.S. list of persons of interest to sacrifice themselves for the country to see oil and banking and other sanctions lifted to see its economy flourish?
Some of these sanctions are imposed on people who are active in large companies, which constitute non-governmental relations between Iran and other nations in trade, commerce, export of goods, and import and export of raw materials, and so on. Sanctioning these people has put additional pressure on Iran. These aren't serious sanctions and don't have that much legal burden on either side. If these sanctions are lifted, talks on other aspects of the JCPOA can be facilitated, which in turn can gain the trust of Tehran. So the Iranian parliament would accept to extend the deadlines it has set so the government can have the time for talks.
There is a thing called Congress in the U.S., but might there be any legal loopholes for individual U.S. states to separately impose sanctions on Iran if the U.S. returns to the deal?
Such a thing doesn't exist in the legal structure of the U.S. It's also incompatible with international law. It's not like any state can arbitrarily do whatever it wants. It's up to the Security Council and the President of the United States.
There is no structure already for imposing sanctions on states, and there is very few precedents for such sanctions in U.S. history. So the second is that companies and countries do not take sanctions by separate states as serious as they take the sanctions by the federal government of the United States.
So how have details on the ground been looking in Vienna further on since a week after a fourth round of talks had begun on Friday, the 7th of May? In dismissing Republican calls to cease nuclear talks, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made a good point on the same day, May the 13th. It was the straightforward answer, the sort of common sense comment Iran has been making all along to fall on deaf ears. He said, "I don't have anything to offer on whether or not there is Iranian involvement in what is taking place in Gaza. But when it comes to any of the malign activities that Iran may or may not engage in, that only underscores the importance that we do everything we can to ensure that Iran never acquires a nuclear weapon." In other words, you want to curb Iran's power? Allow talks to go on in Vienna to see if we can return to mutual compliance with the JCPOA. That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. But do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after, as you never know what's on. Nuclear talks are ongoing, and we are getting close to election day in Iran. Till next time, bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The United States, which has exported weapons to the fake regime of Israel every year since 1961, is by far the Zionist regime's biggest weapons supplier. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Frank Andrews Ryder. This article is published under the heading Arms Trade, which countries and companies are selling weapons to Israeli regime. Stay tuned for more. The United States is by far the biggest exporter of arms to the Zionist regime. Between 2009 to 2020, more than 70% of arms the Zionist regime bought came from the U.S., according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, Arms Transfers Database, which only includes major conventional weapons. According to SIPRI numbers, the U.S. has exported arms to the Zionist regime every year since 1961. It's harder to track arms that have actually been delivered, but between 2013 and 2017, the U.S. delivered $4.9 billion in arms to the Zionist regime, according to the UK-based Campaign Against the Arms Trade, that is CAUT. The U.S. continued to export weapons to the Zionist regime when it emerged in 2009. For example, that the Zionist regime forces had indiscriminately used white phosphorus shells on Palestinians, a war crime, according to Human Rights Watch. In 2014, Amnesty International accused the Zionist regime of the same charge for disproportionate attacks that killed scores of civilians in Rafah, southern Gaza. The following year, the export value of U.S. weapons to the Zionist regime almost doubled, according to SIPRI figures. And under a security assistance agreement spanning 2019 to 2028, the United States has agreed, subject to congressional approval, to give the Zionist regime $3.8 billion annually in foreign military financing, most of which it has to spend on U.S.-made weapons. That's around 20% of the Zionist regime's war budget, according to NBC, and almost three-fifths of U.S. foreign military financing worldwide. But the U.S. also sometimes gives additional funds on top of its annual contribution. It has given an extra $1.6 billion since 2011 for the Zionist regime's Iron Dome anti-missile system, with parts that are made in the U.S. Andrew Smith of CAUT told the Middle East Eye, Israel has a very advanced arms industry that could likely sustain the bombardment for at least a short period of time. However, its major combat aircraft comes from the U.S., referring to U.S. F-16 fighter jets, which continue to pummel the strip. Even if the capacity to build them exists in occupied Palestine, they would obviously take a long time to assemble. In terms of munitions, a lot of these are imported, but I'd expect they could be produced in occupied Palestine, he added. He said, obviously, in this hypothetical scenario, the tradition to domestically produce arms would take time and would not be cheap. The long list of private U.S. companies involved in supplying the Zionist regime with arms includes Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, Ametek, UTC Aerospace, and Raytheon, according to CAUT. The second biggest exporter of weapons to the regime of Israel is Germany, which accounted for 24% of the Zionist regime's arms imports between 2009 to 2020. Germany does not provide data on the weapons it delivers, but it issued licenses for arms sales to the Zionist regime worth 1.6 billion euros, from 2013 to 2017, according to Kat. CPRI figures show Germany sold weapons to the Zionist regime throughout 1960s and 1970s, and has done so every year since 1994. The first talks between the two regimes date back to 1957, according to Haaretz, which noted that in 1960, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion met in New York with German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer and emphasized Israel's need for small submarines and anti-aircraft missiles. While the U.S. has helped with many of the Zionist regime's air needs, Germany still provides submarines. German shipbuilder Thyssenkrupp Marine Systems has built six Dolphin submarines for the Zionist regime, according to Kat, while the German headquartered company Renk AG helps equip the Zionist regime's Merkava tanks. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel voiced solidarity with the Zionist regime in a call with Netanyahu recently, according to her spokesperson, reaffirming the regime's right to defend itself against rocket attacks from Gaza. Italy is next, having provided 5.6% of the Zionist regime's major conventional arms imports between 2009 to 2020, according to CPRI. From 2013 to 2017, Italy delivered €476 million worth of arms to the Zionist regime, according to Kat. The two regimes have done deals in recent years whereby the Zionist regime has got training aircraft in return for missiles and other weapons, according to Defense News. Italy joined other European countries in criticizing the Zionist regime settlements in Sheikh Jarrah and elsewhere earlier in May, but the country continues to export weapons. Canada accounted for around 0.3% of the Zionist regime's imports of major conventional weapons between 2009 to 2021, according to CPRI numbers. Jagmeet Singh of Canada's New Democratic Party recently called for Canada to halt arms sales to the Zionist regime in light of recent events. Canada sent $13.7 million in military hardware and technology to the occupied Palestine in 2019, equating to 0.4% of total arms exports, according to the Globe and Mail. The UK, though not in CPRI's database in recent years, also sells weapons to the Zionist regime and has licensed £400 million in arms since 2015, according to Kat. The NGO is calling for the UK to end weapon sales and military support to the Zionist regime forces and investigate if UK arms have been used to bomb Gaza. The actual amount the UK exports to the Zionist regime is far higher than publicly available numbers due to an OPAC system of weapons sales. Open licenses, basically permissions to export, which keep the value of arms and their quantities secret. Smith of Cut told MEE that roughly 30 to 40% of UK arms sales to the Zionist regime are likely done under open license, but we simply don't know which weapons they are or how they are used. Private British companies that help supply the Zionist regime with arms or military hardware include BAE Systems, Atlas Electronic UK, MPE, Meggitt Penny, Plus, Guise Control, Redmayne Engineering, Senior PLC, Land Rover, and G4S, according to Kat. What's more, the UK spends millions of pounds annually on Israeli weapons systems. Elbit Systems, the Zionist regime's largest arms producer, has several subsidiaries in the UK, as do several US arms manufacturers. One of their factories in Oldham has been a target for pro-Palestine protesters in recent months. Many of the weapons exported by the UK to the Zionist regime, including aircraft, drones, grenades, bombs, missiles, and ammunition, are the kind of arms that are likely to be used in this sort of bombing campaign, according to a Qatar statement referring to the ongoing bombardment. It would not be the first time, it added. A government review in 2014 found 12 licenses for arms likely used in that year's bombardment of Gaza, while in 2010, then Foreign Secretary David Miliband said that arms made in the UK had almost certainly been used in occupied Palestine 2009 bombing campaign of the Gaza Strip.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. The second week of Israeli aggression on Palestinian territories, sophisticated ordnances claim more than 210 Palestinian lives, almost half of them women and children. Palestinian resistance groups are also performing retaliatory attacks on Tel Aviv and other Israeli targets. They insist they will keep raiding Israel as long as Gaza and other Palestinian areas are coming under heavy Israeli land, navy, and air raids. And this debate show will explore various aspects of the escalation with our panelists. Let's first go to our own correspondent in Gaza City, Ashraf Shannon, and see what update he has for us there. Ashraf, over to you.
The number of fatalities in the Gaza Strip because of the ongoing Israeli atrocities has risen to 213, and over 1,500 people have been injured, and as you mentioned, nearly half of them are children and women, and also large numbers of elderly people, and there are at least a dozen doctors and teachers and people from all professions were killed in this ongoing onslaught since 9 days ago. Israel continues to pound the enclave, the Israeli Navy, gunboats, Israeli tanks, Israeli warplanes, using all kinds of weapons to attack over 2 million Palestinian civilians in the enclave. All the targets are actually, most of the targets that have been hit in Gaza by the Israeli regime forces were civilian buildings and civilian infrastructure. Israel bombed at least three buildings known to house media companies, although dozens of other buildings also that were targeted had journalists in them. The health situation has reached a very critical point. The health, Ministry of Health is appealing for aid and surgical supplies to help take care of the wounded, especially amid of the coronavirus pandemic.
All right, thank you for that update, Ashraf Shannon in Gaza City. Take good care of yourself, Ashraf. Now, joining me are a couple of guests. We'll have historian and journalist Brecht Jonkers out of Hasselt, Belgium. Also, international coordinator with the Samidun Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, is joining us from Vancouver. Good to have you both on the show. Beginning with Belgium, Brecht, Israel continues to pound Gaza. More than 200 Palestinians have been killed. So how do you size up this latest Israeli war on Palestinians, which is now in its second week?
Well, unfortunately, it is not a unique situation in as far as we're talking about, of course, Zionist attacks on Gaza and on the Palestinian people and the Palestinian nation in general.
This has been part and parcel, of course, of the Zionist entity and the Zionist project since the very start, since 1948, and this has only gotten worse, of course, after the war of 1967. And ever since, and unfortunately, we have seen time and again in the last 20, 30 years that despite continuous diplomatical attempts and attempts at negotiations, that every so often there is a major war happening from the Zionist entity against Palestinian targets, especially very often tied to matters such as Israeli elections, whenever they need to get domestic attention away from internal problems, they turn on Palestinians, which is, of course, a victim that they always are more than willing to attack. Now, the difference, why this is, in a way, in a unique situation, is that the resistance and the resilience of the Palestinian people, which has always been very admirable and very successful in the fact that they continue to resist and continue to exist as a resilient and resistant people. But this resistance has kicked up a few notches, I think, in the past week or the past 9 days, in which you see not just the typical retaliation, but very, very precise and very successful retaliatory attacks. We have had missiles land in Tel Aviv, missiles land in near the Dimona nuclear weapons facility that Israel maintains in the Negev Desert. We have seen now reports surfacing of the Israeli Zionist offshore oil and gas platforms being targeted by remote control submarines. And now, of course, in the latest reports, we see that the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, which is the armed wing of Fatah in Ramallah, is starting to also, you know, take up arms and call for all-out revolutionary struggle. This is basically, I would call it, a third intifada forming and building up all across the Palestinian nation, which is a very hopeful symbol and a very hopeful signal that real lasting change and liberty to Palestine could indeed be around the corner, especially when you think about the fact that so far all of this resistance has been purely domestic. There has not yet been external support directly from Lebanon or from Syria, for example. Right. When this kicked off, the situation could get even could change even faster.
Over to Vancouver, Charlotte. The Biden administration just approved a $735 million arms sale to Israel. What's the U.S. role? How big a role does the U.S. have in this Israeli onslaught against the Palestinians?
Well, the U.S. has a major role in the Israeli attack on the Palestinian people. And I mean, this, again, is also something that's not new. When Palestinians are fighting back against Zionist bombs and weaponry and the Israeli war machine, they're also confronting the full might and power of U.S. imperialism. And so it really shows that in many ways the Palestinian people and the Palestinian resistance are protecting humanity on the front lines. When we look at the U.S., every single year, the U.S. provides $3.8 billion a year in aid to Israel. And this aid is military aid. This is aid that is directly aimed at funding and supporting the Zionist war machine that is attacking Palestinians, occupying Palestinian land, and engaging in settler colonialism. If we look back from the beginning of the Zionist project, the Israeli state, the Israeli entity, was always seen as essentially kind of an aircraft carrier for imperialism, whether that was British colonialism or U.S. imperialism. And today, the U.S. is fully responsible for these crimes that are taking place, for the massacres that are taking place in Gaza. And that's why it is so important for people in the United States to take action, to demonstrate, to organize, to build the boycott movement, and to hold political officials accountable and make it clear that all U.S. aid to Israel must stop immediately and that sanctions must be imposed on the Israeli entity.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bresht, the United States says also this is not the only thing that it has done. It's also blocked the U.N. Security Council meeting or any action or statement on the Israeli war on Gaza. We had the Palestinian envoy to the UN just an hour ago in a presser there. He said that they tried so hard, there were consensus. There was only one country, meaning the U.S., that has stopped this meeting from happening. Now they're asking for a General Assembly meeting and all that, and a lot of countries are supporting it. So, and the U.S., he said that they promised to do something undercover to stop this Israeli aggression, but that didn't happen either.
Yeah, well, no, of course, this is a very... It's when I read the information and the developments of the United States intervention in the UN Security Council and trying to block any and all, even theoretical condemnation, even if it's just verbal, just in words, condemnation of the Zionist aggression. Again, this is unfortunately nothing new and unfortunately nothing shocking, but at the same time, that's why I say it's a bit of a double story, because at the same time, in terms of, especially when we're talking about Palestine and about the oppression by the Palestinians by Zionism, the United Nations has very often been somewhat of a paper tiger, a toothless lion, so to say, in which they have never really done much to really help the Palestinian people. In fact, unfortunately, it was one of the first acts that the United Nations took as an organization was the creation of the Zionist entity on the top of Palestine. Of course, back then, this was with a very limited amount of membership, which was mostly dominated by the West. But still, and even ever since then, the United Nations has, of course, denounced, after the war of 1967, the Zionist illegal settlements in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem and on Gaza and the occupation of the Sinai and the Golan Heights. But when push comes to shove, there has been very little work done by the United Nations, and one of the major reasons for that being, of course, the undemocratic functioning of the United Nations Security Council, in which one permanent member can block everything. Even if the entire world were to unite in the United Nations, the United States alone could still block this with its veto power. And the same goes for France and the United Kingdom, who are also two major pillars of Zionism in Europe. So this is in a very, it's an unfortunate situation to be in, and that's why I feel bad in a way for the Palestinian representatives in the United Nations, because some of these diplomats are probably very sincere believers in the negotiated solution, but they are getting slapped over and over again with the impossibility of their job and the impossibility of their mission. And I believe that in the end, you will see, as has been shown so often in the past, in times of when dealing with oppression, when dealing with imperialism and colonialism, is that the only option to solve this is resistance. Even in terms of South Africa, which for a major part was indeed where a part it was brought down by international pressure. This international pressure only came as a result of decades of internal resistance and revolutionary struggle led by people such as Nelson Mandela. Only after that, after 20, 30 years of resistance, the United Nations and the international community finally decided to step in and impose sanctions. But this is very, very unlikely, unfortunately, to be done, these sanctions to be applied on Israel. So at this point, I pin my hopes not so much on the UN, but on the internal resistance of the Palestinian people that will, in the end, put the Zionists for the fact that they will have no option but to pack their bags and leave.
Okay. Now, Charlotte, what's your perspective on this? I mean, the responsibility of international organizations, UN being one of them, and also that of the international community in the midst of all this savagery that we're witnessing against the Palestinians?
Yes, well, I mean, it's very unfortunate to note that, you know, it's certainly in recent years and much to date, the United Nations has been effectively blocked or controlled or dominated by the United States and fellow imperialist powers, especially in Europe and Canada and elsewhere. That being said, it's absolutely necessary on a popular level for people around the world. And if we look at the streets of, you know, every major city, and not just major city, but small towns and villages around the world, we're seeing tens and hundreds of thousands and even millions of people globally taking to the streets and carrying the Palestinian flag as a symbol of humanity, resistance, solidarity, in justice over injustice. And so when we see these massive demonstrations everywhere around the world standing with Palestine, that what we need to do is to translate that sentiment and that solidarity into action and into accountability. And that means struggling and organizing in the United States, in Europe, in Canada, in Australia, elsewhere, to do everything that we can to tie the hands of imperialism and struggle within the belly of the beast to stop these crimes that are taking place against the Palestinian people. That's one reason why, I mean, when we say boycott Israel, yeah, this is just a kind of a small action for individuals to take. But the more the international isolation of Israel grows, the more that we are able to provide real and meaningful support to the Palestinian resistance, who are the actors that are actually making this victory of the Palestinian people possible. And so when we talk about boycott, demonstrating, organizing, we're not talking about an alternative to the resistance. We're talking about the international support that is important to support this Palestinian, Arab, and international struggle for justice and accountability. And that includes holding accountable the United Nations and the representatives that are refusing to take action and are allowing massacres to continue to be perpetuated against the Palestinian people. And despite the fact that there are pages and pages and pages of UN resolutions on Palestine that have never been implemented, and that essentially the United States forced the withdrawal of the resolution recognizing that Zionism is racism, the fact is that Zionism is racism, and this has been recognized by the vast majority of the world. And the fact is that Palestinians have the right to resist, have the right to engage in armed struggle, just like all colonized people fighting occupation and oppression. And this has been recognized. This is a fundamental part of international law. And so applying international law in Palestine means supporting Palestinian resistance. It means supporting the liberation of Palestine, and it means putting an end to colonialism.
Okay. Now, Breshta, regarding this worldwide condemnation of Tel Aviv and its aggression against Palestinians growing, and Charlotte just mentioned a number of the instances, rallies in support of Palestinians all over the world, even in the Western world, in Europe, in Paris, Rome, elsewhere, in the U.S., San Francisco, Washington, Boston, elsewhere, you had people out there, and this is getting louder and louder. And does this mean, is this an indication of, let's call it a PR defeat for Tel Aviv and Washington's agenda for the Palestinians?
I think we're definitely seeing a change. We're not quite there yet, I believe, because, of course, the Hasbara agenda, the agenda of Zionist and the practice of Zionist propaganda is still extremely strong, and they influence, they have a huge influence on the political system, especially in Western Europe and North America. And they continue, of course, to have a very active social media presence that still spreads a lot of misinformation. But indeed, as indeed has been said by the other guest, there is a growing amount of activism. And indeed, not just in the bigger cities, but also in the small towns. We were speaking, for example, here in Belgium, even smaller towns, just places with a couple of thousand inhabitants, have their own small rallies pro-Palestine coming up also in the coming few days. So these are rallies of people who, in many cases, these are people who never really participated much in let's say, in long-standing pro-Palestine or anti-Zionist campaign. These are people who are not necessarily ideologically committed to any specific ideology, but they feel deep down that there is a great and grave injustice being done. Of course, when I say we're not quite there yet, there is still a lot of work that needs to be done, because there still remains a major, idea that still exists in the West of a quote-unquote, both sides are bad, that idea in which they believe that both sides should put down their arms and negotiate, which is a very idealistic way of thinking, considering that the Palestinians have been trying for the past 73 years and it hasn't really gotten them anywhere. But still the fact that people start to understand that a certain form of resistance is logical, that a certain form of rebellion and revolutionary sentiment of the Palestinian people is a logical next step to take, and that Israel needs to back off and needs to withdraw and needs to basically needs to go back, needs to pedal back on its idea of establishing a ethno-state for what they consider to be the Jewish race. There is a lot of popular sentiment nowadays that says, you know, this sort of ethno-state system is not of this time. It is not something that we can accept any longer. It is in violation of international law, of common human decency. So when I see that happening, that fills me with a certain sense of optimism that a lot of people across the West, they defy their political leaders, because all across Western Europe, with the possible exception of Ireland, the political elite is staunchly pro-Zionist, including here in Belgium. There have been constant apologetics for the bombing of Gaza, constant misinformation campaigns trying to blame everything on Hamas. But the people are starting to get fed up with these lies and start to get fed up with these, let's say, these idiotic attempts to justify mass murder. That's when you see people come to terms with the fact that this is a struggle not just against Israel in particular, but that it's part of a wider anti-imperialist struggle, anti-colonial struggle, that is part of the modern society if you want the country to be independent and to be free. So that is why I believe, as has been said, that this is it's an hopeful development that I hope will continue in the near future.
Okay. We have only 1 minute left, Charlotte. Let's also take a look at the way that some Arab states have acted. They not only remained, they kept their deafening silence against all these atrocities by the Tel Aviv regime. They even turned their back, and they normalized, they kind of signed that so-called normalization deals with the Tel Aviv regime. What makes them do that? We have only 1 minute.
Unfortunately, many reactionary Arab regimes are in the pocket of U.S. imperialism, but I think that one thing is very clear. This current uprising is putting an end once and for all to the project of Arab normalization with Israel. It once again, they believed that they would be able to pass this, that they would be able to elevate their collaboration to a public level against Palestine. But what has happened is this situation is redirecting the compass of the region towards Palestine and towards liberation and towards confrontation of Zionism and imperialism against all of the attempts to alter the situation, to instead force Arabs to fight against one another in the interest of imperialism. People are recognizing the real enemy and the real struggle that has to be fought, and normalization and the project of normalization is on the road to its ultimate defeat.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments and contribution. Historian and journalist Bryce Jonkers in Hassel, Belgium, international coordinator with the Summit in Palestine.